They never did find it, so Grandfather gave him a new hat the day he left when the house was finished. It was in Grandfather's office, and Grandfather said the architect took the new hat and looked at it and burst into tears. A little haired, wild-faced man with 2 days' stubble of beard, who came out of the cave fighting like a wildcat, hurt leg and all, with the dogs barking and the niggers whooping and hollering with deadly and merry anticipation, like they were under the impression that since the race had lasted more than 24 hours, the rules would be automatically abrogated, and they would not have to wait to cook him. Until Sutphen waded in with a short stick and beat niggers and dogs all away, leaving the architect standing there, not scared worth a damn either, just panting a little, and Grandfather said a little sick in the face where the niggers had mishandled his leg in the heat of the capture, and making them a speech in French, a long one and so fast that Grandfather said probably another Frenchman could not have understood all of it. But it sounded fine. Grandfather said even he, all of them, could tell that the architect was not apologizing. It was fine, Grandfather said, and he said how Sutphen turned toward him, but he, Grandfather, was already approaching the architect, holding out the bottle of whiskey already uncorked. And Grandfather saw the eyes in the gaunt face, the eyes desperate and hopeless, but indomitable, too, invincible, too. Not beaten yet by a damn sight, Grandfather said. And all that 50-odd hours of dark and swamp and sleeplessness and fatigue and no grub and nowhere to go and no hope of getting there. Just a will to endure and a foreknowing of defeat, but not beat yet by a damn sight. And he took the bottle in one of his little dirty coon-like hands and raised the other hand and even fumbled about his head for a second before he remembered that the hat was gone, then flung the hand up in a gesture that Grandfather said you simply could not describe, that seemed to gather all misfortune and defeat that the human race ever suffered into a little pinch in his fingers like dust and fling it backward over his head, and raised the bottle and bowed first to Grandfather, then to all the other men sitting their horses in a circle and looking at him. And then he took not only the first drink of neat whiskey he ever took in his life, but the drink of it that he could no more have conceived himself taken than the Brahmin can believe that that situation can conceivably arise in which he will eat dog. Quentin ceased. At once Shreve said, "All right, don't bother to say he stopped now, just go on." But Quentin did not continue at once. The flat, curiously dead voice, the downcast face, the relaxed body not stirring except to breathe, the two of them not moving except to breathe, both young, both born within the same year, the one in Alberta, the other in Mississippi. Born half a continent apart, yet joined, connected, after a fashion, in a sort of geographical transubstantiation by that continental trough, that river which runs not only through the physical land of which it is the geologic umbilical, not only runs through the spiritual lives of the beings within its scope, but is very environment itself, which laughs at degrees of latitude and temperature, though some of these beings, like Shreve, have never seen it. The two of them, who 4 months ago had never laid eyes on one another, yet who since had slept in the same room and eaten side by side of the same food, and used the same books from which to prepare to recite in the same freshman courses, facing one another across the lamp-lit table on which lay the fragile Pandora's box of scrawled paper which had filled with violent and unratiocinative jinns and demons this snug monastic coin, this dreamy and heatless alcove of what we call the best of thought. "Just don't bother," Shreve said. "Just get on with it." "That would take 30 years, Quentin said. It was 30 years before he told Grandfather any more of it. Maybe he was too busy. All his time for spare talkin' taken up with furtherin' that design which he had in mind, and his only relaxation fightin' his wild niggers in the stable where the men could hitch their horses and come up from the back and not be seen from the house, because he was already married now, his house finished and he already arrested for stealin' it and freed again, so that was all settled, with a wife and 2 children—no, 3— in it, and his land cleared and planted with the seed Grandfather loaned him, and him gettin' rich good and steady now." "Yes," Shreve said. "Mr. Coldfield, what was that?" "I don't know," Quentin said. "Nobody ever did know for certain. It was something about a bill of lading, some way he persuaded Mr. Coldfield to use his credit. One of those things that when they work you were smart, and when they don't you change your name and move to Texas. and Father said how Mr. Coldfield must have sat back there in his little store and watched his wagon load of stock double maybe every 10 years, or at least not lose any ground, and seen the chance to do that very same thing all the time, only his conscience, not his courage, Father said he had plenty of that, wouldn't let him. Then Sutphen came along and offered to do it, and he and Mr. Coldfield to divide the loot if it worked, and he, Sutphen, to take all the blame if it didn't. And Mr. Coldfield let him. Father said it was because Mr. Coldfield did not believe it would work, that they would get away with it, only he couldn't quit thinking about it, and so when they tried it and it failed, he, Mr. Coldfield, would be able to get it out of his mind then, and that when it did fail and they were caught, Mr. Coldfield would insist on taking his share of the blame as penance and expiation for having sinned in his mind all those years. Because Mr. Coldfield never did believe it would work, so when he saw that it was going to work, had worked, the least thing he could do was to refuse to take his share of the profits. That when he saw that it had worked, it was his conscience he hated, not Sutphen. His conscience and the land, the country, which had created his conscience and then offered the opportunity to have made all that money to the conscience which it had created, which could do nothing but decline. Hated that country so much that he was even glad when he saw it drifting closer and closer to a doomed and fatal war. That he would have joined the Yankee army, Father said, only he was not a soldier, and knew that he would either be killed or die of hardship, and so not be present on that day when the South would realize that it was now paying the price for having erected its economic edifice not on the rock of stern morality, but on the shifting sands of opportunism and moral brigandage. So he chose the only gesture he could think of to impress his disapproval on those who should outlive the fightin' and so participate in the remorse.
"Sure," Shreve said, "that's fine. But Sutphen, the design, get on now."
"Yes," Quentin said, "the design. Getting richer and richer. It must have looked fine and clear ahead for him now, house finished, and even bigger and whiter than the one he had gone to the door of that day, and the nigger came in his monkey clothes and told him to go to the back, and he with his own brand of niggers even, which the man who lay in the hammock with his shoes off didn't have, to cull one from and train him to go to the door when his turn came for a little boy without any shoes on, and with his pap's cut-down pants for clothes to come and knock on it. Only Father said that that wasn't it now, that when he came to Grandfather's office that day after the 30 years, and not trying to excuse now any more than he had tried in the bottom that night when they ran the architect, but just to explain now, trying hard to explain now, because now he was old and knew it, knew it was being old that he had to talk against, time shortening ahead of him that could and would do things to his chances and possibilities, even if he had no more doubt of his bones and flesh than he did of his will and courage. Telling Grandfather that the boy symbol at the door wasn't it, because the boy symbol was just the figment of the amazed and desperate child. That now he would take that boy in where he would never again need to stand on the outside of a white door and knock at it. And not at all for mere shelter, but so that that boy, that whatever nameless stranger, could shut that door himself forever behind him on all that he had ever known, and look ahead along the still undivulged light rays in which his descendants, who might not even hear his, the boy's, name, waited to be born without even having to know that they had once been riven forever free from brutehood, just as his own, Sutphen's, children were.
"Don't say it's just me that sounds like your old man," Shreve said, "but go on. Sutphen's children, go on."
This book is continued on Disc 8.
"Don't say it's just me that sounds like your old man," Shreve said, "but go on. Sutphen's children, go on."
"Yes," Quentin said, "the two children." Thinking, "Yes, maybe we are both father. Maybe nothing ever happens once and is finished. Maybe happen is never once, but like ripples, maybe on water after the pebble sinks, the ripples moving on, spreading, the pool attached by a narrow umbilical water cord to the next pool, which the first pool feeds, has fed, did feed. Let this second pool contain a different temperature of water, a different molecularity of having seen, felt, remembered, reflect in a different tone the infinite unchanging sky, it doesn't matter.
That pebble's watery echo, whose fall it did not even see, moves across its surface too at the original ripple space, to the old ineradicable rhythm. Thinking, yes, we are both Father, or maybe Father and I are both Shreve. Maybe it took Father and me both to make Shreve, or Shreve and me both to make Father, or maybe Thomas Sutphen to make all of us. Yes, the two children, the son and the daughter, by sex and age so glibbed to the design that he might have planned that too. By character, mental and physical, so glibbed to it that he might have called them out of the celestial herd of seraphs and cherubim, like he chose his 20 niggers out of whatever swapping there must have been when he repudiated that first wife and that child, when he discovered that they would not be adjunctive to the forwarding of the design. And Grandfather said that there was no conscience about that, that Sutphen sat in the office that afternoon after 30 years, and told him how his conscience had bothered him somewhat at first, but that he had argued calmly and logically with his conscience until it was settled. Just as he must have argued with his conscience about his and Mr. Coldfield's bill of lading, only probably not as long here, since time here would be pressing, until that was settled. How he granted that by certain lights there was injustice in what he did, but that he had obviated that as much as lay in his power by being above board in the matter. That he could have simply deserted her, could have taken his hat and walked out, but he did not. And that he had what Grandfather would have to admit was a good and valid claim, if not to the whole place which he alone had saved, as well as the lives of all the white people on it, at least to that portion of it which had been specifically described and deeded to him in the marriage settlement, which he had entered in good faith, with no reservations as to his obscure origin and material equipment, while there had been not only reservation but actual misrepresentation on their part, and misrepresentation of such a crass nature as to have not only voided and frustrated without his knowing it the central motivation of his entire design, but would have made an ironic delusion of all that he had suffered and endured in the past, and all that he could ever accomplish in the future toward that design, which claim he had voluntarily relinquished, taken only the 20 niggers out of all he might have claimed, and which many another man in his place would have insisted upon keeping, and, in which contention would have been supported by both legal and moral sanction, even if not the delicate one of conscience. And Grandfather not saying, wait, wait, now, because it was that innocence again, that innocence which believed that the ingredients of morality were like the ingredients of pie or cake. And once you had measured them, and balanced them, and mixed them, and put them into the oven, it was all finished, and nothing but pie or cake could come out. Yes, sitting there in Grandfather's office trying to explain with that patient, amazed recapitulation, not to Grandfather, and not to himself, because Grandfather said that his very calmness was indication that he had long since given up any hope of ever understanding it, but trying to explain to circumstance, to fate itself, the logical steps by which he had arrived at a result absolutely and forever incredible, repeating the clear and simple synopsis of his history, which he and Grandfather both now knew, as if he were trying to explain it to an intractable and unpredictable child. You see, I had a design in my mind. Whether it was a good or a bad design is beside the point. The question is, where did I make the mistake in it? What did I do or misdo in it? Whom or what injure by it to the extent which this would indicate? I had a design. To accomplish it, I should require money, a house, a plantation, slaves, a family, incidentally, of course, a wife. I set out to acquire these, asking no favor of any man. I even risked my life at one time, as I told you, though, as I also told you, I did not undertake this risk purely and simply to gain a wife, though it did have that result. But that is beside the point also. Suffice that I had the wife, accepted her in good faith, with no reservations about myself, and I expected as much from them. I did not even demand, mind, as one of my obscure origin might have been expected to do, or at least be condoned in the doing, out of ignorance of gentility in dealing with gentle-born people. I did not demand. I accepted them at their own valuation, while insisting on my own part upon explaining fully about myself and my progenitors. Yet they deliberately withheld from me the one fact which I have reason to know they were aware would have caused me to decline the entire matter. Otherwise they would not have withheld it from me. a fact which I did not learn until after my son was born. And even then I did not act hastily. I could have reminded them of these wasted years, these years which would now leave me behind with my schedule not only the amount of elapsed time which their number represented, but that compensatory amount of time represented by their number which I should now have to spend to advance myself once more to the point I had reached and lost. But I did not. I merely explained how this new fact rendered it impossible that this woman and child be incorporated in my design, and following which, as I told you, I made no attempt to keep not only that which I might consider myself to have earned at the risk of my life, but which had been given to me by signed testimonials. But on the contrary, I declined and resigned all right and claim to this in order that I might repair whatever injustice I might be considered to have done by so providing for the two persons whom I might be considered to have deprived of anything I might later possess. And this was agreed to, mind, agreed to between the two parties. And yet, and after more than 30 years after my conscience had finally assured me that if I had done an injustice, I had done what I could to rectify it, and grandfather not saying, "Wait now," but saying, hollering, maybe even, "Conscience, conscience, good God, man, what else did you expect? Didn't the very affinity and instinct for misfortune of a man who had spent that much time in a monastery even, let alone one who had lived that many years as you lived them, tell you better than that? Didn't the dread and fear of females which you must have drawn in with the primary mammalian milk teach you better? What kind of abysmal and purblind innocence could that have been which someone told you to call virginity? What conscience to trade with which would have warranted you in the belief that you could have bought immunity from her for no other coin but justice?" It was at this point that Shreve went to the bedroom and put on the bathrobe. He did not say wait. He just rose and left Quentin sitting before the table, the open book and the letter, and went out and returned in the robe and sat again and took up the cold pipe, though without filling it anew or lighting it as it was. "All right," he said. "So that Christmas Henry brought him home, into the house, and the demon looked up and saw the face he believed he had paid off and discharged 28 years ago. Go on." "Yes," Quentin said. "Father said he probably named him himself. Charles Bond. Charles Good. He didn't tell grandfather that he did, but grandfather believed he did, would have. That would have been a part of the cleaning up, just as he would have done his share toward cleaning up the exploded caps and musket cartridges after the siege if he hadn't been sick, or maybe engaged. He would have insisted on it, maybe. The conscience, again, which could not allow her and the child any place in the design, even though he could have closed his eyes and, if not fooled the rest of the world as they had fooled him, at least have frightened any man out of speaking the secret aloud. The same conscience which would not permit the child, since it was a boy, to bear either his name or that of its maternal grandfather, yet which would also forbid him to do the customary and provide a quick husband for the discarded woman and so give his son an authentic name. He chose the name himself, grandfather believed, just as he named them all, the Charles Goods and the Clytemnestras and Henry and Judith and all of them, that entire fecundity of dragon's teeth, as father called it. And father said, "Your father," Shreve said, "he seems to have gotten awful lot of delayed information awful quick, after having waited 45 years. If he knew all this, what was his reason for telling you that the trouble between Henry and Bond was the Octoroon woman?" "He didn't know it then. Grandfather didn't tell him all of it either, like Supper never told grandfather quite all of it." "Then who did tell him?"
"I did."
Quentin did not move, did not look up while Shreve watched him. "The day after after that night when we—" "Oh," Shreve said, "after you and the old aunt. I see. Go on." "And father said—" "Said how he must have stood there on the front gallery that afternoon and waited for Henry and the friend Henry had been writing home about all fall to come up the drive, and that maybe after Henry wrote the name in the first letter, Sutphen probably told himself it couldn't be, that there was a limit even to irony beyond which it became either just vicious but not fatal horseplay or harmless coincidence, since father said that even Sutphen probably knew that nobody yet ever invented a name that somebody didn't own now or hadn't owned once. And they rode up at last, and Henry said, 'Father, this is Charles,' and he—"
"The demon,"
Shreve said. Saw the face and knew that there are situations where coincidence is no more than the little child that rushes out onto a football field to take part in the game, and the players run over and around the unscathed head and go on and shock together. And in the fury of the struggle for the facts, called gain or loss, nobody even remembers the child, nor saw who came and snatched it back from dissolution. That he stood there at his own door, just as he had imagined, planned, designed, and sure enough, and after 50 years, the forlorn, nameless, and homeless lost child came to knock at it, and no monkey-dressed nigger anywhere under the sun to come to the door and order the child away. And Father said that even then, even though he knew that Barn and Judith had never laid eyes on one another, he must have felt and heard the design, house, position, posterity, and all, come down like it had been built out of smoke, making no sound, creating no rush of displaced air, and not even leaving any debris. And he not calling it retribution, no sins of the father come home to roost, not even calling it bad luck, but just a mistake. That mistake, which he could not discover himself and which he came to Grandfather, not to excuse but just to review the facts for an impartial, and Grandfather said he believed a legally trained mind, to examine and find and point out to him. Not moral retribution, you see, just an old mistake, in fact, which a man of courage and shrewdness, the one of which he now knew he possessed, the other of which he believed that he had now learned, acquired, could still combat it if he could only find out what the mistake had been. Because he did not give up. He never did give up. Grandfather said that his subsequent actions, the fact that for a time he did nothing and so perhaps helped to bring about the very situation which he dreaded, were not the result of any failing of courage or shrewdness or ruthlessness, but were the result of his conviction that it had all come from a mistake, and until he discovered what that mistake had been, he did not intend to risk making another one. So he invited Barn into the house, and for the 2 weeks of the vacation, only it didn't take that long, Father said that probably Mrs. Sutphen had Judith and Barn already engaged from the moment she saw Barn's name in Henry's first letter. He watched Barn and Henry and Judith, or watched Barn and Judith, rather, because he would have already known about Henry and Barn from Henry's letters about him from the school, watched them for 2 weeks and did nothing. Then Henry and Barn went back to school, and now the nigger groom that fetched the mail back and forth each week between Oxford and Sutphen's Hundred brought letters to Judith now that were not in Henry's hand, and that not necessary either, Father said, because Mrs. Sutphen was already covering the town and county both with news of that engagement that Father said didn't exist yet. And still he did nothing. He didn't do anything at all until spring was almost over, and Henry wrote that he was bringing Barn home with him to stay a day or two before Barn went home. Then Sutphen went to New Orleans. Whether he chose that time to go in order to get Barn and his mother together and thrash the business out for good and all or not, nobody knows. Just as nobody knows whether he ever saw the mother or not while he was there, if she received him or refused to receive him, or if she did and he tried once more to come to terms with her, buy her off maybe with money now, since Father said that a man who could believe that a scorned and outraged and angry woman could be bought off with formal logic would believe that she could be placated with money too, and it didn't work. Or if Barn was there, and it was Barn himself who refused the offer, though nobody ever did know if Barn ever knew Sutphen was his father or not, whether he was trying to revenge his mother or not at first and only later fell in love, only later succumbed to the current of retribution and fatality which Miss Rosa said Sutphen had started and had doomed all his blood to, black and white both. But it didn't work, evidently. And the next Christmas came, and Henry and Barn came to Sutphen's Hundred again, and now Sutphen saw that there was no help for it. That Judith was in love with Barn, and whether Barn wanted revenge or was just caught and sunk and doomed too, it was all the same. So it seems that he sent for Henry that Christmas Eve just before supper time. Father said that maybe by now, after his New Orleans trip, he had learned at last enough about women to know it wouldn't do any good to go to Judith first, and told Henry. And he knew what Henry would say, and Henry said it, and he took the lie from his son, and Henry knew by his father taking the lie that what his father had told him was true. And Father said that he, Sutphen, probably knew what Henry would do, too, and counted on Henry doing it because he still believed that it had been only a minor tactical mistake,
And so he was like a skirmisher who is outnumbered yet cannot retreat, who believes that if he is just patient enough and clever enough and calm enough and alert enough, he can get the enemy scattered and pick them off one by one. And Henry did it. And he, Suffren, probably knew what Henry would do next, too, that Henry, too, would go to New Orleans to find out for himself. Then it was 61, and Suffren knew what they would do now. Not only what Henry would do, but what he would force Bond to do. Maybe, being a demon, though it would not require a demon to foresee war now, he even foresaw that Henry and Bond would join that student company at the university. He may have had some way of watching, knowing the day their names appeared on the roster, some way of knowing where the company was even before Grandfather became colonel of the regiment the company was in, until he got hurt at Pittsburgh Landing, where Bond was wounded, and came home to get used to not having any right arm, and Suffren came home in 64 with the two tombstones and talked to Grandfather in the office that day before both of them went back to the war. Knew all the time where Henry and Bond were, that they had been all the time in Grandfather's regiment, where Grandfather could look after them in a fashion even if Grandfather didn't know that he was doing it. Even if they needed watching, because Suffren must have known about the probation, too, what Henry was doing now. Holding all three of them, himself and Judith and Bond, in that suspension while he wrestled with his conscience to make it come to terms with what he wanted to do, just like his father had that time more than 30 years ago. Maybe even turned fatalist like Bond now, and given the war a chance to settle the whole business by killing him or Bond or both of them. But with no help, no fudging on his part, because it was him that carried Bond to the rear after Pittsburgh Landing. Or maybe he knew that the South would be whipped, and then there wouldn't be anything left that mattered that much, worth getting that heated over, worth protesting against or suffering for or dying for or even living for. That was the day he came to the office. His, the demon's, Shreve said. One day of leave at home. Came home with his tombstones, and Judith was there. And I reckon he looked at her, and she looked at him, and he said, "You know where he is," and Judith didn't lie to him. And he knew Henry. He said, "But you've not heard from him yet," and Judith didn't lie about that either, and she didn't cry either, because both of them knew what would be in the letter when it came, so he didn't have to ask. When he writes you that he is coming, you and Clytie will start making the wedding dress, even if Judith would have lied to him about that, which she would not have. So he put one of the stones on Ellen's grave and set the other one up in the hall and came in to see Grandfather. Trying to explain it, seeing if Grandfather could discover that mistake which he believed was the sole cause of his problem. Sitting there in his worn and shabby uniform, with his worn gauntlets and faded sash, and he would have had the plume by all means. He might have had to discard his saber, but he would have had the plume. The plume in his hat broken and frayed and soiled, with his horse saddled and waiting in the street below and 1,000 miles to ride to find his regiment. Yet he's sitting there on the one afternoon of his leave as though he had 1,000 of them, as if there were no haste nor urgency anywhere under the sun, and that when he departed he had no further to go than the 12 miles out to Suffren's Hundred, and 1,000 days or maybe even years of monotony and rich peace. And he, even after he would become dead, still there, still watching the fine grandsons and great-grandsons springing as far as eye could reach. He's still, even though dead in the earth, that same fine figure of a man that Wash Jones called him. But not now. Now fog-bound by his own private embattlement of personal morality, that picayune splitting of abstract hairs, while, Grandfather said, Rome vanished and Jericho crumbled, that this would be right if, or that would be wrong but, of slowing blood and stiffening bones and arteries that Father says men resort to in senility, who while young and supple and strong reacted to a single simple yes and a single simple no, as instantaneous and complete and unthinking as the snapping on and off of electricity. Sitting there and talking, and now Grandfather not knowing what he was talking about, because now Grandfather said he did not believe that Suffren himself knew, because even yet Suffren had not quite told him all of it. And this, that morality, again, Grandfather said, that morality which would not permit him to malign or traduce the memory of his first wife, or at least the memory of the marriage, even though he felt that he had been tricked by it, not even to an acquaintance in whose confidence and discretion he trusted enough to wish to justify himself,
not even to his son by another marriage in order to preserve the status of his life's attainment and desire, except as a last resort. Not that he would hesitate then, Grandfather said, but not until then. He had been tricked by it himself, but he had extricated himself without asking or receiving help from any man. Let anyone else who might be so imposed upon do the same. Sitting there and moralizing on the fact that no matter which course he chose, the result would be that that design and plan to which he had given 50 years of his life had just as well never have existed at all by almost exactly 50 years. And Grandfather, not knowing what choice he was talking about even, what second choice he was faced with, until the very last word he spoke before he got up and put on his hat and shook Grandfather's left hand and rode away. This second choice, need to choose, as obscure to Grandfather as the reason for the first, the repudiation, had been. So that Grandfather did not even say, I don't know which you should choose, not because that was all he could have said, and so to say that would be less than no answer at all, but that anything he might have said would have been less than no answer at all, since Sutphen was not listening, did not expect an answer, who had not come for pity, and there was no advice that he could have taken, and justification he had already coerced from his conscience 30 years ago. And he still knew that he had courage, and though he may have come to doubt lately that he had acquired that shrewdness which at one time he believed he had, he still believed that it existed somewhere in the world to be learned, and that if it could be learned, he would yet learn it. And maybe even this, Grandfather said. If shrewdness could not extricate him this second time as it had before, he could at least depend on the courage to find him will and strength to make a third start toward that design, as it had found him to make the second with. Who came into the office not for pity and not for help, because Grandfather said he had never learned how to ask anybody for help or anything else, and so he would not have known what to do with the help if Grandfather could have given it to him, but came just with that sober and quiet bemusement, hoping maybe, if he hoped at all, if he were doing anything but just thinking out loud at all, that the legal mind might perceive and clarify that initial mistake which he still insisted on, which he himself had not been able to find. I was faced with condoning a fact which had been foisted upon me without my knowledge during the process of building toward my design, which meant the absolute and irrevocable negation of the design, or in holding to my original plan for the design in pursuit of which I had incurred this negation. I chose, and I made to the fullest what atonement lay in my power for whatever injury I might have done in choosing, paying even more for the privilege of choosing, as I chose, than I might have been expected to, or even, by law, required. Yet I am now faced with a second necessity to choose, the curious factor of which is not, as you pointed out and as first appeared to me, that the necessity for a new choice should have arisen, but that either choice which I might make, either course which I might choose, leads to the same result. Either I destroy my design with my own hand, which will happen if I am forced to play my last trump card, or do nothing, let matters take the course which I know they will take, and see my design complete itself quite normally and naturally and successfully to the public eye, yet to my own in such fashion as to be a mockery and a betrayal of that little boy who approached that door 50 years ago and was turned away, for whose vindication the whole plan was conceived and carried forward to the moment of this choice, this second choice devolving out of that first one, which in its turn was forced on me as the result of an agreement, an arrangement which I had entered in good faith, concealing nothing, while the other party or parties to it concealed from me the one very factor which would destroy the entire plan and design which I had been working toward, concealed it so well that it was not until after the child was born that I discovered that this factor existed. "Your old man," Shreve said. When your grandfather was telling this to him, he didn't know any more what your grandfather was talking about than your grandfather knew what the demon was talking about when the demon told it to him, did he? And when your old man told it to you, you wouldn't have known what anybody was talking about if he hadn't been out there and seen Clytie. Is that right? Yes, Quentin said. Grandfather was the only friend he had. The demon had? Quentin didn't answer, didn't move. It was cold in the room now. The heat was almost gone out of the radiators. The cold iron fluting, stern signal and admonition for sleeping. The little death, the renewal. It had been some time now since the chimes had rung 11. All right,
Shreve said. He was hugging himself into the bathrobe now as he had formerly hugged himself inside his pink, naked, almost hairless skin. He chose. He chose lechery. So do I. But go on. His remark was not intended for flippancy nor even derogation. It was born, if from any source, of that incorrigible unsentimental sentimentality of the young which takes the form of hard and often crass levity, to which, by the way, Quentin paid no attention whatever, resuming as if he had never been interrupted, his face still lowered, still brooding apparently on the open letter upon the open book between his hands. He left for Virginia that night. Grandfather said how he went to the window and watched him ride across the square on the gaunt black stallion, erect in his faded gray, the hat with its broken plume cocked a little, yet not quite so much as the beaver of the old days. As if, Grandfather said, even with his martial rank and prerogatives he did not quite swagger like he used to do, not because he was chastened by misfortune or spent or even war-wearied, but as though even while riding he was still bemused in that state in which he struggled to hold clear and free above a maelstrom of unpredictable and unreasoning human beings, not his head for breath, and not so much his 50 years of effort and striving to establish a posterity, but his code of logic and morality, his formula and recipe of fact and deduction, whose balanced sum and product declined, refused to swim or even float. Saw him approach the Holston house, and saw old Mr. McCaslin and two other old men hobble out and stop him. He sitting the stallion and talking to them, and his voice not raised, Grandfather said. Yet the very sober quality of his gestures and the set of his shoulders forensic, oratorical. Then he went on. He could still reach Sutphen's Hundred before dark, so it was probably after supper that he headed the stallion toward the Atlantic Ocean. He and Judith facing one another again for maybe a full minute, he not needin' to say, I will stop it if I can, she not needin' to say, stop it then if you can, but just goodbye, the kiss on the brow and no tears, a word to Clytie and to Wash, master to slave, baron to retainer. Well, Clytie, take care of Miss Judith. Wash, I'll send you a piece of Abe Lincoln's coattail from Washington. And I reckon Wash answered like it used to be under the scuppernongs with the demijohn and the well bucket. Sure, Colonel, kill every one of the varmints. So he ate the whole cake and drank the parched acorn coffee and rode away. Then it was 65, and the army, Grandfather had gone back to it too, he was a brigadier now, though I reckon this was for more reason than because he just had one arm, had retreated across Georgia and into Carolina, and they all knew it wouldn't be very much longer now. Then one day Lee sent Johnston some reinforcements from one of his corps, and Grandfather found out that the 23rd Mississippi was one of the regiments. And he, Grandfather, didn't know what had happened, whether Sutphen had found out in some way that Henry had at last coerced his conscience into agreeing with him, as his, Henry's father, had done 30 years ago, whether Judith perhaps had written her father that she had heard from Barn at last, and what she and Barn intended to do, or if the four of them had just reached as one person that point where something had to be done, had to happen. He, Grandfather, didn't know. He just learned one morning that Sutphen had ridden up to Grandfather's old regiment's headquarters and asked and received permission to speak to Henry, and did speak to him, and then rode away again before midnight. So he got his choice made after all, Shreve said. He played that trump after all. And so he came home and found... Wait, Quentin said. What he must have wanted to find, or anyway what he was going to find. Wait, I tell you, Quentin said, though still he did not move nor even raise his voice, that voice with its tense, suffused, restrained quality. I'm telling. Am I going to have to hear it all again? He thought. I'm going to have to hear it all over again. I'm already hearing it all over again. I'm listening to it all over again. I shall have to never listen to anything else but this again, forever, so apparently not only a man never outlives his father, but not even his friends and acquaintances do. That at least, regarding which, he should have needed no word nor warning, even if Judith would have sent him one, sent him acknowledgment that she was beaten, who, according to Mr. Compson, would no more have sent him acknowledgment that he had beat her, than she waited, who Miss Coldfield said was not bereaved, and met him on his return, not with the fury and despair, perhaps, which he might have expected, even though knowing as little, having learned as little about women as Mr. Compson said he had, yet certainly with something other than the icy calm with which, according to Miss Coldfield, she met him. The kiss again after almost 2 years on the brow, the voices, the speeches, quiet, contained, almost impersonal. And, yes, Henry killed him, followed by the brief tears which ceased on the instant when they began, as if the moisture consisted of a single sheet or layer thin as a cigarette paper and in the shape of a human face. The, ah, Clytie, ah, Rosa. Well, Wash, I was unable to penetrate far enough behind the Yankee lines to cut a piece from that coattail as I promised you. The, from Jones, guffaw, the chortle, the old imbecile stability of the articulated mud which, Mr. Compson said, outlasts the victories and the defeats both. Well, Colonel, they killed us, but they ain't whopped us yet, air they? And that was all. He had returned. He was home again, where his problem now was haste, passing time, the need to hurry. He was not concerned, Mr. Compson said, about the courage and the will, nor even about the shrewdness now. He was not for one moment concerned about his ability to start the third time. All that he was concerned about was the possibility that he might not have time sufficient to do it in, regain his lost ground in. He did not waste any of what time he had, either. The will and the shrewdness, too, he did not waste, though he doubtless did not consider it to have been either his will or his shrewdness which supplied waiting to his hand the opportunity, and it was probably less of shrewdness and more of courage than even will which got him engaged to Miss Rosa within a period of 3 months and almost before she was aware of the fact. Miss Rosa, the chief disciple and advocate of that cult of demon-harrying, of which he was the chief object, even though not victim, engaged to him before she had got accustomed to having him in the house. Yes, more of courage than even will, yet something of shrewdness, too. The shrewdness acquired in excruciating driblets through the 50 years, suddenly capitulant and retroactive, or suddenly sprouting and flowering like a seed lain fallow in a vacuum, or in a single iron clod. Because he seemed to perceive without stopping, in that passage through the house which was an unbroken continuation of the long journey from Virginia, the pause not to greet his family but merely to pick up Jones and drag him on out to the briar-choked fields and fallen fences and clap axe or mattock into his hands, the one weak spot, the one spot vulnerable to assault in Miss Rose's embattled spinsterhood, and to assault and carry this in one stride, with something of the ruthless tactical skill of his old master. The 23rd Mississippi was in Jackson's corps at one time. And then the shrewdness failed him again. It broke down. It vanished into that old impotent logic and morality which had betrayed him before. And what day might it have been? What furrow might he have stopped dead in, one foot advanced, the unsentient plow handles in his instantaneous unsentient hands? What fence panel held in midair as though it had no weight by muscles which could not feel it, when he realized that there was more in his problem than just lack of time, that the problem contained some superdistillation of this lack, that he was now past 60 and that possibly he could get but one more son, had at best but one more son in his loins, as the old cannon might know when it has just one more shot in its corporeality. So he suggested what he suggested to her, and she did what he should have known she would do, and would have known probably if he had not bogged himself again in his morality, which had all the parts but which refused to run, to move. Hence the proposal, the outrage and unbelief, the tide, the blast of indignation and anger, upon which Miss Rosa vanished from Sutphen's Hundred, her air-ballooned skirts spread upon the flood, chip-light, her bonnet, possibly one of Ellen's which she had prowled out of the attic, clapped fast onto her head, rigid and precarious with rage. And he standing there with the reins over his arm, with perhaps something like smiling inside his beard and about the eyes, which was not smiling but the crinkled concentration of furious thinking. The haste, the need for it, the urgency but not fear, not concern. Just the fact that he had missed that time, though luckily it was just a spotting shot with a light charge, and the old gun, the old barrel and carriage none the worse. Only next time there might not be enough powder for both a spotting shot and then a full-sized load. The fact that the thread of shrewdness and courage and will ran onto the same spool which the thread of his remaining days ran onto, and that spool almost near enough for him to reach out his hand and touch it. But this was no grave concern yet, since it, the old logic, the old morality which had never yet failed to fail him, was already fallen into pattern, already showing him conclusively that he had been right, just as he knew he had been, and therefore what had happened was just a delusion and did not actually exist. "No," Shreve said, "you wait. Let me play a while now." Now Wash, him, the demon, standing there with the horse, the saddle charger, the sheathed saber, the gray waiting to be laid peacefully away among the moths and all lost save dishonor, then the voice of the faithful gravedigger who opened the play and would close it, coming out of the wings like Shakespeare's very self. "Will, Colonel, them mought have whupped us, but they ain't kilt us yet, air they?" This was not flippancy either. It, too, was just that protective coloring of levity behind which the youthful shame of being moved hid itself. Out of which Quentin also spoke, the reason for Quentin's sullen bemusement, the, on both their parts, flipness, the strained clowning. The two of them, whether they knew it or not, in the cold room, it was quite cold now, dedicated to that best of ratiocination which, after all, was a good deal like Sutphen's morality and Miss Coldfield's demonizing. This room not only dedicated to it, but set aside for it, and suitably so, since it would be here above any other place that it, the logic and the morality, could do the least amount of harm. The two of them back to back as though at the last ditch, saying no to Quentin's Mississippi shade, who in life had acted and reacted to the minimum of logic and morality, who dying had escaped it completely, who dead remained not only indifferent but impervious to it, somehow a thousand times more potent and alive. There was no harm intended by Shreve, and no harm taken, since Quentin did not even stop. He did not even falter, taking Shreve up in stride without comma or colon or paragraph. No reserve to risk a spot and shot with now, so he started this one like you start a rabbit out of a briar patch, with a little chunk of dried mud thrown by hand. Maybe it was the first string of beads out of his and Wash's little store where he would get mad at his customers, the niggers and the trash and the haggling, and turn them out and lock the door and drink himself blind. And maybe Wash delivered the beads himself, Father said, that was down at the gate when he rode back from the war that day, that after he went away with the regiment would tell folks that he, Wash, was looking after Colonel's place and niggers until after a while maybe he even believed it. Father's mother said how when the Sutphen niggers first heard about what he was saying, they would stop him in the road that came up out of the bottom where the old fishing camp was that Sutphen let him and the granddaughter, she was about 8 then, live in. There would be too many of them for him to whip them all, to even try to, risk trying to. And they would ask him why he wasn't at the war, and he would say, "Get out in my road, niggers!" And then it would be the outright laughing, asking one another, except it was not one another but him, "Who him calling us niggers?" And he would rush at them with a stick, and them avoiding him just enough, not mad at all, just laughing. And he was still carrying fish and animals he killed, or maybe stole, and vegetables up to the house, when that was about all Mrs. Sutphen and Judith, and Clytie, too, had to live on. And Clytie would not let him come into the kitchen with the basket even, saying, "Stop right there, white man. Stop right where you is. You ain't never crossed this door while Colonel was here, and you ain't going to cross it now." Which was true, only Father said there was a kind of pride in it. That he had never tried to enter the house, even though he believed that if he had tried, Sutphen would not have let them repulse him. Like, Father said, he might have said to himself, "The reason I won't try it ain't that I refuse to give any black nigger the chance to tell me I can't, but because I ain't going to force Mr. Tom to have to cuss a nigger or take a cussin' from his wife on my account." But they would drink together under the Scuppernong arbor on the Sunday afternoons, and on the weekdays he would see Sutphen, the fine figure of the man, as he called it, on the black stallion, galloping about the plantation, and Father said how for that moment Wash's heart would be quiet and proud both, and that maybe it would seem to him that this world were niggers, that the Bible said had been created and cursed by God to be brute and vassal to all men of white skin, were better found and housed and even clothed than he and his granddaughter, that this world where he walked always in mocking and jeering echoes of nigger laughter was just a dream and an illusion, and that the actual world was the one where his own lonely apotheosis, Father said, galloped on the black thoroughbred.
thinking maybe, Father said, how the book said that all men were created in the image of God, and so all men were the same in God's eyes anyway, looked the same to God at least. And so he would look at Sutphen and think, a fine, proud man. If God himself was to come down and ride the natural earth, that's what he would aim to look like. Maybe he even delivered the first string of beads himself. And Father said maybe each of the ribbons afterward during the next 3 years while the girl matured fast like girls of that kind do. Or anyway, he would know and recognize each and every ribbon when he saw it on her, even when she lied to him about where and how she got it, which she probably did not, since she would be bound to know that he had been seeing the ribbons in the showcase every day for 3 years, and would have known them as well as he knew his own shoes. And not only he knew them, but all the other men, the customers and the loungers, the white and the black, that would be sitting and squatting about the store's gallery to watch her pass. Not quite defiant, and not quite cringing, and not quite flaunting the ribbons and the beads, but almost. Not quite any of them, but a little of all, bold, sullen, and fearful. But Father said how Wash's heart was probably still quiet, even after he saw the dress and spoke about it. Probably only a little grave now, and watching her secret defiant, frightened face, while she told him, before he had asked, maybe too insistent, too quick to volunteer it, that Miss Judith had given it to her, helped her to make it. And Father said maybe he realized all of a sudden and without warning that when he passed the men on the gallery they would look after him too, and that they already knew that which he had just thought they were probably thinking. But Father said his heart was still quiet, even now, and that he answered, if he answered at all, stopped the protestations and disclaimers at all. "Sure now, if Colonel and Miss Judith wanted to give hit to you, I hope you minded to thank them." "Not alarmed," Father said. "Just thoughtful, just grave." And Father saw how that afternoon Grandfather rode out to see Sutphen about something, and there was nobody in the front of the store, and he was about to go out and go up to the house, when he heard the voices from the back, and he walked on toward them, and so he overheard them before he could begin to not listen, and before he could make them hear him calling Sutphen's name. Grandfather couldn't see them yet. He hadn't even got to where they could hear him yet. But he said he knew exactly how they would be. Sutphen having already told Wash to get the jug out, and then Wash spoke, and Sutphen beginning to turn, realizing that Wash wasn't getting the jug before he comprehended the import of what Wash was saying, then comprehending that and still half-turned, and then all of a sudden kind of reared back and flinging his head up, looking at Wash, and Wash standing there, not cringing either, in that attitude dogged and quiet and not cringing. And Sutphen said, "What about the dress?" And Grandfather said it was Sutphen's voice that was short and sharp, not Wash's, that Wash's voice was just flat and quiet, not abject, just patient and slow. "I have knowed you for gone on 20 years now. I ain't never denied yit to do what you told me to do, and I'm a man past 60, and she ain't nothing but a 15-year-old gal." And Sutphen said, "Meanin' that I'd harm the girl? Aye, a man as old as you are?" And Wash, "If you was e'er a other man, I'd say you was as old as me. And old or no old, I wouldn't let her keep that dress nor nothing else that come from your hand. But you are different." And Sutphen, "How different?" And Grandfather said how Wash did not answer, and that he called again now, and neither of them heard him. And then Sutphen said, "So that's why you are afraid of me?" And Wash said, "I ain't afraid, because you are brave. It ain't that you were a brave man at 1 second or minute or hour of your life and got a paper to show hit from General Lee, but you are brave, the same as you are alive and breathing. That's why it's different. Hit don't need no ticket from nobody to tell me that. And I know that whatever your hands touch, whether hit's a regiment of men or an ignorant gal or just a hound dog, that you will make hit right." Then Grandfather heard Sutphen move, sudden and sharp, and Grandfather said he reckoned, thought, just about what he imagined Wash was thinking. But all Sutphen said was, "Get the jug." "Sure, Colonel," Wash said. So that Sunday came, a year after that day, and 3 years after he had suggested to Miss Rosa that they try it first, and if it was a boy and lived, they would be married. It was before daylight, and he was expecting his mare to foal to the black stallion. So when he left the house before day that morning, Judah thought he was going to the stable, who knew what and how much about her father and Wash's granddaughter nobody knew. How much she could not have helped but know from what Clytie must have known, May have or may not have told her, whether or no, since everybody else white or black in the neighborhood knew who had ever seen the girl pass in the ribbons and beads which they all recognized. How much she may have refused to discover during the fitting and sewing of that dress. Father said Judith actually did this. This was no lie that the girl told Wash. The two of them alone all day long for about a week in the house. And what they must have talked about, what Judith must have talked about while the girl stood around in what she possessed to call underclothes, with her sullen, defiant, secret, watchful face, answering what, telling what that Judith may or may not have tried to shut her eyes to, nobody knew. So it was not until he failed to return at dinner time that she went or sent Clytie to the stable and found that the mare had foaled in the night but that her father was not there. And it was not until mid-afternoon that she found a half-grown boy and paid him a nickel to go down to the old fish camp and ask Wash where Sutphen was. And the boy walked whistling around the corner of the rotten cabin and saw maybe the scythe first, maybe the body first lying in the weeds which Wash had not yet cut. And as he screamed, he looked up and saw Wash in the window, watching him. Then about a week later they caught the nigger, the midwife, and she told how she didn't know that Wash was there at all that dawn when she heard the horse and then Sutphen's feet, and he came in and stood over the pallet where the girl and the baby were and said, "Penelope," that was the mare, "foaled this morning, a damn fine colt, going to be the spitting image of his daddy when I rode him north in 61. Do you remember?" And the old nigger said she said, "Yes, marster," and that he jerked the riding whip toward the pallet and said, "Well, damn your black-eyed horse or mare," and that she told him and that he stood there for a minute and he didn't move at all, with the riding whip against his leg and the lattices of sunlight from the unchinked wall falling upon him, across his white hair and his beard that hadn't turned at all yet. And she said she saw his eyes and then his teeth inside his beard, and that she would have run then, only she couldn't seem to make her legs bear to get up and run. And then he looked at the girl on the pallet again and said, "Well, Millie, too bad you're not a mare, too. Then I could give you a decent stall in the stable," and turned and went out. Only she could not move even yet, and she didn't even know that Wash was outside there. She just heard Sutphen say, "Stand back, Wash, don't you touch me." And then Wash, his voice soft and hardly loud enough to reach her, "I'm going to tetch you, Colonel." And Sutphen again, "Stand back, Wash," sharp now. And then she heard the whip on Wash's face, but she didn't know if she heard the scythe or not, because now she found out that she could move, get up, run out of the cabin and into the weeds, running. "Wait," Shreve said, "wait. You mean that he had got the sun at last that he wanted, yet still he..." Walked the 3 miles and back before midnight to fetch the old nigger, then sat on the sagging gallery until daylight came, and the granddaughter stopped screaming inside the cabin, and he even heard the baby once, waiting for Sutphen. And Father said his heart was quiet then too, even though he knew what they would be saying in every cabin about the land by nightfall, just as he had known what they were saying during the last 4 or 5 months while his granddaughter's condition, which he had never tried to conceal, could no longer be mistaken. "Wash Jones has fixed old Sutphen at last. It's taken him 20 years to do it, but he has got a holt of old Sutphen at last, where Sutphen will either have to tear me to squeal." That's what Father said he was thinking while he waited outside on the gallery where the old nigger had sent him, ordered him out, standing there maybe by the very post where the scythe had leaned rusting for 2 years, while the granddaughter's screams came steady as a clock now, but his own heart quiet, not at all concerned nor alarmed. And Father said that maybe while he stood befogged in his fumbling and groping, that morality of his that was a good deal like Sutphen's, that told him he was right in the face of all fact and usage and everything else, which had always been somehow mixed up and involved with galloping hooves even during the old peace that nobody remembered, and in which during the 4 years of the war which he had not attended, the galloping had been only the more gallant and proud and thunderous. Father said that maybe he got his answer, that maybe there broke free and plain in mid-gallop against the yellow sky of dawn the fine proud image of the man on the fine proud image of the stallion, and that the fumbling and the groping broke clear and free too, not in justification or explanation or extenuation or excuse, Father said, but as the apotheosis, lonely, explicable, beyond all human fouling. He is bigger than all them Yankees that killed us and ourn, that killed his wife and widowed his daughter and drove his son from home, that stole his niggers and ruined his land. Bigger than this whole county that he fit for, and in payment for which has brung him to keep a little country store for his bread and meat. Bigger than the scorn and denial which it held to his lips like the bitter cup in the book. And how could I have lived nigh to him for 20 years without being touched and changed by him? Maybe I'm not as big as he is, and maybe I did not do any of the galloping. But at least I was drug along where he went, and me and him can still do it, and will ever so. If so be, he will show me what he aims for me to do. And maybe still standing there and holding the stallion's reins after Sutphen had entered the cabin, still hearing the galloping, watching the proud galloping image merge and pass, galloping through avatars which mark the accumulation of years, time, to the fine climax where it galloped without weariness or progress, forever and forever immortal beneath the brandished saber and the shot-torn flags rushing down a sky in color like thunder. Stood there and heard Sutphen inside the house speak his single sentence of salutation, inquiry, and farewell to the granddaughter. And father said that for a second Wash must not have felt the very earth under his feet while he watched Sutphen emerge from the house, the riding whip in his hand, thinking quietly like in a dream, "I can't have heard what I know I heard. I just know I can't," thinking, "that was what got him up. It was that colt. It ain't me or mine either. It wasn't even his own that got him out of bed." Maybe feeling no earth, no stability, even yet. Maybe not even hearing his own voice when Sutphen saw his face. The face of the man who in 20 years he had no more known to make any move save at command than he had the stallion which he rode. And stopped. "You said if she was a mare you could give her a decent stall in the stable." Maybe not even hearing Sutphen when he said, sudden and sharp, "Stand back, don't you touch me." Only he must have heard that, because he answered it. "I'm going to tetch you, Colonel." And Sutphen said, "Stand back, Wash," again before the old woman heard the whip. Only there were 2 blows with the whip. They found the 2 welts on Wash's face that night. Maybe the 2 blows even knocked him down. Maybe it was while he was getting up that he put his hand on the scythe. "Wait," Shreve said. "For Christ's sake, wait. You mean that he..." Sat there all that day in the little window where he could watch the road. Probably laid the scythe down and went straight into the house, where maybe the granddaughter on the pallet asked querulously what it was, and he answered, "What? What racket, honey?" And maybe he tried to persuade her to eat, too. The side meat he had probably brought home from the store Saturday night, or maybe the candy, trying to tempt her with it, maybe. The nickel's worth of stale, jellified glue out of a striped sack. And maybe ate himself, and then sat at the window where he could look out above the body and the scythe and the weeds below, and watch the road. Because he was sitting there when the half-grown boy came around the corner of the house whistling and saw him. And father said he must have realized then that it would not be much after dark when it would happen, that he must have sat there and sensed, felt them gathering with the horses and dogs and guns, the curious and the vengeful, men of Sutphen's own kind who used to eat at his table with him back when he, Wash, had yet to approach nearer the house than the Scuppernong Arbor. Men who had led the way, shown the other and lesser ones how to fight in battles, who might also possess signed papers from the generals saying that they were among the first and foremost of the brave, who had galloped also in the old days arrogant and proud on the fine horses about the fine plantations, symbol also of admiration and hope, instruments, too, of despair and grief. These it was whom he was expected to run from, and it seemed to him probably that he had no less to run from than he had to run to. That if he ran, he would be fleeing merely one set of bragging and evil shadows for another, since they, men, were all of a kind throughout all of earth which he knew, and he old, too old to run far, even if he were to run, who could never escape them, no matter how much or how far he ran. A man past 60 could not expect to run that far, far enough to escape beyond the boundaries of earth where such men lived, set the order and the rule of living. And father said that maybe for the first time in his life he began to comprehend how it had been possible for Yankees or any other army to have whipped them. The gallant, the proud, the brave, the acknowledged and chosen best among them all to bear the courage and honor and pride. It would probably be about sunset now, and probably he could feel them quite near now. Father said it probably seemed to him that he could even hear them, all the voices, the murmuring of tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow beyond the immediate fury. Old Wash Jones come a tumble at last. He thought he had Sutphen, but Sutphen fooled him. He thought he had him, but old Wash Jones got fooled. And then maybe even saying it aloud, shouting it, Father said, "But I never expected that, Colonel. You know I never." Until maybe the granddaughter stirred and spoke querulously again, and he went and quieted her and returned to talk to himself again, but careful now, quiet now, since Sutphen was close enough to hear him easy, without shouting. "You know I never. You know I never expected or asked or wanted nothing from our living man but what I expected from you. And I never asked that. I didn't think it would need. I just said to myself, I don't need to. What need has a fellow like Wash Jones to question or doubt the man that General Lee himself said in a hand-wrote ticket that he was brave? Brave! And maybe it would be loud again, forgetting again. Brave! Better if ne'er one of them had ever rid back in 65. Thinking, better if his kind and mine too had never drawn the breath of life on this earth. Better that all who remain of us be blasted from the face of it than that another Wash Jones should see his whole life shredded from him and shrivel away like a dried shuck thrown onto the fire. Then they rode up. He must have been listening to them as they came down the road, the dogs and the horses, and seen the lanterns, since it was dark now. And Major Despain, who was sheriff then, got down and saw the body, though he said he did not see Wash nor know that he was there until Wash spoke his name quietly from the window almost in his face. "That you, Major?" Despain told him to come on out, and he said how Wash's voice was quite quiet when he said he would be out in just a minute. It was too quiet, too calm. So much too quiet and calm that Despain said he did not realize for a moment that it was too calm and quiet. "In just a minute, soon as I see about my granddaughter." "We'll see to her," Despain said. "You come on out." "Sho, Major," Wash said, "in just a minute." So they waited in front of the dark house, and the next day Father said there were 100 that remembered about the butcher knife that he kept hidden and razor sharp, the one thing in his sloven life that he was ever known to take pride in or care of. Only by the time they remembered all this, it was too late. So they didn't know what he was about. They just heard him moving inside the dark house. Then they heard the granddaughter's voice, fretful and querulous. "Who is it? Light the lamp, Grandpa." Then his voice, "It won't need no light, honey. It won't take but a minute." Then Despain drew his pistol and said, "You, Wash, come out of there." And still Wash didn't answer, murmuring still to the granddaughter, "Where are you?" And the fretful voice answering, "Right here. Where else would I be? What is—" Then Despain said, "Jones!" And he was already fumbling at the broken steps when the granddaughter screamed. And now all the men there claimed that they heard the knife on both the neck bones, though Despain didn't. He just said he knew that Wash had come out onto the gallery and that he sprang back before he found out that it was not toward him Wash was running, but toward the end of the gallery where the body lay, but that he did not think about the scythe. He just ran backward a few feet when he saw Wash stoop and rise again, and now Wash was running toward him. Only he was running toward them all, Despain said, running into the lantern so that now they could see the scythe raised above his head. They could see his face, his eyes too, as he ran with the scythe above his head, straight into the lanterns and the gun barrels, making no sound, no outcry, while Despain ran backward before him, saying, "Jones, stop, stop, or I'll kill you! Jones, Jones, Jones!" "Wait," Shreve said, "you mean that he got the son he wanted, after all that trouble, and then turned right around and—" "Yes." Sitting in Grandfather's office that afternoon, with his head kind of flung back a little, explaining to Grandfather like he might have been explaining arithmetic to Henry back in the fourth grade. "You see, all I wanted was just a son, which seems to me, when I look about at my contemporary scene, no exorbitant gift from nature or circumstance to demand." "Will you wait," Shreve said, "that with the son he went to all that trouble to get lying right there behind him in the cabin, he would have to taunt the grandfather into killing first him and then the child too?" "What?" Quentin said. "It wasn't a son. It was a girl." "Oh," Shreve said. Come on, let's get out of this damn icebox and go to bed.